So about 10 days ago, the SZBA, which stands for the Soto Zen Buddhist Association, which is this national umbrella group for Soto Zen priests, had an online gathering, I'll call it. And oh, I have to look there. And, I'm sorry, I want to see who's over there.
You can look over there, too.
Yeah, I can look over. And so during that day, there were a couple of Dharma talks, and one of the Dharma talks was given by a teacher named Jan Chosen Bays Roshi. And there was a particular story she told in her talk that really touched me. And she was speaking about her teacher, Maizumi Roshi, who was one of the original Japanese teachers who came to the United States in the mid-1900s. And somebody had interviewed him, was interviewing him, and asked him, is there a comparable, is there something comparable to an enduring soul in Buddhism? And at first, Maizumi Roshi said, no. But then when he thought about it, he said, what we do have is our enduring vow. And the vow goes beyond any particular person and or lineage or teacher or anything. And it's a vow is something that is the Buddhist vow, which I'll refer to as the Bodhisattva vow, is handed down from one practitioner to another. Often we say from a teacher to a student, but it can be from the whole Sangha to any member of the Sangha. And I was very impressed by that answer. And so I said, aha, that's what I'm going to talk about today. So I went online and I very quickly got Jen Chosen-Bays Roshi's book that's called The Vow Powered Life, and A Simple Method for Living with Purpose. And she's probably in her early 70s now, so she's been around quite a while and has interacted with many of teachers from the past and present. And in one of her first chapters, she has a little verse from Katagiri Roshi, which I really appreciated. And it says, living by vow, silently sitting, 63 years, plum blossoms begin to bloom, the jeweled mirror reflects life as it is. And she said that Katagiri Roshi wrote this poem a few weeks before he died. And he died on March 1st of 1990. So in Japan, it is the time when plum blossoms begin to bloom. But I was reflecting on his words and thinking that sometimes the blossoms in our lives take quite a while to bloom. And being 63 years old myself, but I'm hoping not quite on death's door, but you never know, that I was like, that's right. I feel like my plum blossoms are just beginning to bloom. And they'll take a while to be in full array, I think. So maybe if they become in full array at all. So, I Are you being okay with?
Yeah, we're fine. Okay. Just go ahead.
Right now at Clouds, there are people who are beginning their Jikai journey and exploring the precepts, and they're participating in a class called Zen Treasures, which is exploring the precepts, and in the fall practice period. And they are formally embracing their Bodhisattva path. The Bodhisattva path, the vow, as I understand it, is to commit to freeing all beings from suffering in the midst of our wobbly lives. And I like the word wobbly that my Dharma brother, Hartman Carl Holtman at Hokyoji, gave me that word for a meaning for dukkha, which is part of the first noble truth that we say life is dukkha, and it's often translated as suffering, and I've always felt like that's not quite right from my point of view. And because the exact meaning of dukkha means a wheel out of kilter, and so a wobbly wheel. And so I really appreciate the wobbliness of our lives, and that life is really presenting us with many challenges and difficulties, that we all experience sickness and old age and death. And I think our big question is there a way that these conditions don't carry us away, don't get us wobbly? That when we get wobbly and we get carried away, that's when the suffering kicks in. So part of our practice is really to stand up straight and do our best to not be troubled by the difficulties in our lives. When we commit our vow to abide by the Buddha's teachings, we give ourselves and the whole world the opportunity to live unencumbered by life's trials and travails. We have the chance to experience deep abiding joy, whether or not we're happy or sad in any particular moment. Vows are what endure. Excuse me. So last January, I was involved in an online practice period with Tenshin Roshi through Green Gulch, and we studied the Lotus Sutra. And at one point, the Buddha predicted that his disciple, Shariputra, would become a Tathagata Buddha, or a fully realized Buddha, in a number of kalpas. And kalpas are supposed to be these very, very, very long periods of time. And this is like he was saying, in like three or four kalpas, you will be a Tathagata. And my first thought, my human small self thought, a few kalpas, that's a long time. What is he celebrating about? That's a really long time. And so, as I thought about it, my conjecture and my story about this is that Shariputra was really happy because he was going to have all this time between the time the Buddha made this prediction and him becoming a Tathagata, to follow the Bodhisattva path and to have that vow to help all beings to be free. And that brought him great joy, and it was a cause for celebration. So I thought that perhaps when all that time passed, it wouldn't just be him becoming a Tathagata, that there was enough time, it seems like a lot of time, two or three or four kalpas, that perhaps everybody could indeed become a Tathagata with him. And that's a great cause for celebration in my book. So that Maizumi Roshi, who I referred to before, told Chosen Base Roshi that life itself is the original vow. And when we're born and we mature and grow up and our lives evolve and unfold, you know, we kind of have a choice to embrace our lives and to make the most of our lives. That there's Chosen Days in this book provides all kinds of different types of vows that we might take in our everyday lives to help and support others. Most are taken up, inspired by how others are conducting themselves, both positively and negatively. I'm sorry, I'm not sure whether I should just look at the camera.
No, you need to look at people in the room too.
I'm sorry, I haven't done this in a while. I haven't done this here. So, excuse me. We might do something because someone is doing something remarkable and that we would like to emulate that remarkable activity. We don't necessarily have to be the leader of a particular activity, just join with others to do beneficial work. At other times, we might commit to a path because we want to do something differently than someone who is doing something that wasn't as beneficial. You know, I think we might all have stories about how, particularly if we have children, and I know not everybody has children, but or even in our own lives, we're going to raise our children differently than my parents raised me. And so something that happened with me is that I grew up on Long Island in a fairly comfortable Jewish town on Long Island, and in my high school maybe there was like 80% Jewish people, and I think the rest were Italians with maybe 1 or 2% of people who weren't Jews or Italians. And so when I had children, I lived in Minneapolis, and what I wanted for my children was to go to school with a variety of different people, of different heritages and ethnicities, and to have a broader view of all the different people in this world or in this country, particularly. And so my kids got a different view of who inhabits this world with us and who inhabits this society with us. And my parents didn't mean anything. You know, they weren't intentionally creating this situation, but I just wanted it to be different. So our vows might be in reaction to something that we didn't particularly relish, or our vows might be in response to seeing a person and saying, I want to do what that person is doing. Kind of like the Buddha saw the wandering mendicant on the road when he was, before he was the Buddha, and he was just the prince trying to figure out his way. Because he really wanted to do things a lot different than his family. So, yes. And you know, there's times too when we look around and there's no particular person we're following, and we want to find something to do to benefit our society and the people around us and the world. And so we might see something that is a hole. And so I was thinking of Philandra Castile's mother, I think her name is Sandra, and after her son was murdered, that he had been a lunchroom staff person in a school in St. Paul here. And she started a fund to help pay lunchroom bills for kids in St. Paul who weren't able to, their families weren't able to pay the bills themselves. And she got so, people contributed so much that it went from just the school that Philandra taught at to all of St. Paul schools and maybe even beyond that. And then other people started this up in other school districts. And so her one act really went through the whole state and perhaps the whole country. And so she saw something that needed to be done and she did it. Another person I was thinking of is Al Franken. And I think last year he started a book-raising activity for a library on an Indian reservation in northern Minnesota. And they got so many books for this new library, it was astounding. And so one person might have the idea, but they can't do it themselves. They're alerting all of us to things that could be done. And we all have that capability. And a couple of weeks ago, Daishin had given a talk here, and she was speaking about how each person might be doing something else, something beneficial. So right now, there might be somebody who's protesting. There might be somebody who's working in a soup kitchen. There might be somebody taking care of their grandchildren, or many other activities. And there are many different ways to have beneficial action that all have a foundation of this heartfelt commitment and vow each of us have. And each of us has our own way of manifesting our vows, and they don't all have to be the same. And it would be a very lopsided world if they were all the same. But the connection that we all have of making this vow, and then the means to manifest the vow, can be different. And Chosen Maids very much speaks about that in this book. So, you know, she's also talking about the vows we have in relationship to other people, relationships of friends we have, our relationships with parents, our relationships with our children, and, you know, we just have to stand up like Jizo, who is the bodhisattva of women and children and beyond, who just stands by people upright in their difficulties and just lends a hand when somebody else needs it. And that's what we can do in our relationships. I know that I have some very dear friends, and one friend particularly who we've had a 40-year relationship, and she is a teacher at another Metro Sangha, but we've had our ups and downs throughout the year, but we have a vow to never walk away, even if it takes us some time to get through our difficulties, to always come back and to not give up. Because our vow is to the relationship of being a friend as much as it is a vow to us as particular people. And that vow for me extends to my marriage and my children and my broader friends and the Sangha, and then ultimately the vow is to the vow itself, beyond any particular person. So in a few minutes, we're going to be conducting an all-ages precept ceremony. And we're all invited to reflect on the vow we may take to live our lives in accord with these precepts, to help free ourselves and others from suffering. And I invite you all to just reflect on what those vows mean in your life, and if those vows give you the energy to live a dynamic life. Because a life with purpose and dynamism really is, the foundation is the vows of our heartfelt commitments we make in our life. I invite you to reflect on your hopes and aspirations in your life that you would like to accomplish. And perhaps you're already doing those things, or perhaps there's something that's been on your mind that hasn't quite happened yet. And I invite you to create the container and create the circumstances for you to be able to work on those aspirations and hopes. Vows give us the energy to live our lives in a wholesome, beneficial way. We each have our own unique ways of expressing our vows that can enhance the lives of all beings in the whole universe. So I know it's a little bit early, but part of what I was hoping to do is to open this up, that if there's people who would like to speak about their vows and hopes and aspirations of things they want to accomplish in their lives, because nothing happens by oneself, that we need the support of our community and people around us to make those aspirations happen. Just like Al Franken or Sandra Castile. They couldn't do it without other people's buy-in and support. So, please, if you would like to speak to things that you aspire to or things you're doing.
I like what you said about not walking away, because that just sort of covers everything. And I think about going through the day and seeing something that I should do something about that. And sometimes I won't do it, I'll be afraid, you know, to step in. And I think that's a really good vow, because I think you need more courage to, you know, to do something that needs to fill the hole that you're talking.
Is there anything you have in mind?
Oh, I just think about driving down the road and I see a homeless person, you know, and I think, okay, I have some dollar bills in my thing. So I usually will do it. Sometimes I'll think, oh, that light's going to turn, and I could have done it, you know, and I think, you know, I should have done it. And I think it's really good. It's a really good vow, because it just reminds me, you know, or somebody needs something to fill in that hole and do it, and kind of like trusting my gut. I guess that, you know, just a general, I just think like I said, that vow covers everything. It just seems to cover the whole thing. That's about it.
Thank you. Anybody in Zoom land? Or two, if there's something you're currently doing.
Cultivation of diligence and not getting up, giving up. And it reminded me of a saying that I heard a long time ago, kind of reflecting Buddhist practice. It's fall down 7, get up 8, right? And I have used that throughout my life, kind of as a reminder of part of this practice is not giving up, is being committed to that vow and to myself and awakening in all beings. And so I also, your talk made me think of another story I heard that has also been really helpful for me is a lot of this practice is, for me, you know, the analogy is you're walking down the street and you fall in a hole and you're in the hole and you're like, how did I get here? And, you know, this is new and you scramble and you know, you finally figure out how to get up and then you walk down the street again and you fall in the hole again. And you're just like, oh my gosh, how did I get here again? And then you walk down the street again and you see the hole and you fall in the hole. And I do it all the time. I'm like, okay, I've been here before. I have more tools. I know how to get out. And then the next time you walk down the street, you see the hole, you go around the hole. And so I just like that. And I heard that in these rooms and through other kind of Zen Dharma talks, and that helps me a lot when I'm going through difficult times. Is awareness is the first step, and it takes me multiple iterations of kind of the same lesson over and over again. And if I can be gentle in that process, then I have a chance of learning something and awakening and touching that compassion, and that is one of the vows for me is working on cultivating that and remembering my humanity. So it's a great talk of being reminded of that. So thank you.
And the last part of that story is
take a different street.
take a different street. You see the hole and you head in a different direction. That's it. Actually, there's another wonderful story that Chosen Bays told in here of two young men who, after 9/11, felt very compelled to sign up for the military. And they went. And so that was their vow, to help protect the country. And they went for their basic training. And in their basic training, they were, part of the training, they were saying, kill, 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 and getting all these people, young soldiers in training to repeat this and to create this, these conditions where these people would feel like they want to kill other people indiscriminately. And these two young men just, I think one of them called the parents and said, we just can't do this. And they went to the sergeants and the commanders and said, we just can't do this. And then they went AWOL. Mm. Because they just could not abide by this kill, kill, kill. They wanted to protect their country, but they weren't into killing innocent people. And then after that, they did go AWOL, but then they took responsibility for going AWOL and showed up for the consequences of going AWOL. The story ended there, so I don't know exactly what happened. But, you know, that if sometimes there's a vow that you, in our everyday life kind of vows, that we need to break, that the conditions changed and what we thought we were committing to and agreeing to isn't what ended up happening. And so there are times when our heartfelt underlying vow to free all beings is there, but the way, the means and the manifestation of those vows can't go on a straight line, and that happens sometimes. But I think it's important to go by that, not walking away, that in some ways we're not walking away from our fundamental vow, but sometimes we have to walk away from the means to manifest the vows.
I also really liked the reminder in your talk that there's so many different ways of living the vow, because I can find myself like doom scrolling, right? Mm-hmm. Where I am online and I'm just seeing all these things where I feel like, oh, like I need to do something about this, and it can feel very overwhelming. And so I have kind of taught myself to stop the doom scrolling and be like, okay, think of two things that I could do. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, when, I don't know, there was like the Texas abortion ban, I'm like, okay, what are two things I can do right now? And so then I donated to an organization that was helping women access abortions as they needed. And then I wrote to my representatives. And so just thinking of what are two things kind of helps me not feel overwhelmed. So it was nice to hear, you know, there are very many different ways and there are a lot of people kind of working for the same thing together.
I think that's really important for us to not get overwhelmed with all the different ways that we can help, and really reflect in our hearts and what the conditions of our lives to find the things we would like to do that can help. Like, I am a person who loves to cook. And so I find my ways to help support people through cooking. And so, and that's something I can do. Or a little vow I have, although I don't think of it as a vow, it's just something I do. If I'm walking in my neighborhood or even not in my neighborhood and I pass somebody by, I say, hello. You know, and it's seemingly such a little thing, and so oftentimes people look up kind of startled, and I smile. Well, you can't see the smile now, but, you know, smiling eyes, and just kind of like, and people respond if you reach out. I find that, you know, it's just a little thing. There are all kinds of little things we can do that are beneficial to our world. This morning I was going to take a bath before coming here, and we have two bathtubs in my house, and I rented this one bathtub, and there were two spiders hanging out in the bathtub. And I said, I'm not going to bother these spiders. I wasn't afraid of them. I was just like, I don't need to bother these spiders. And I went upstairs to take a bath. You know, it's like little things. You know? These spiders can live. They're no bother. So. All right.
So I was happy to hear you mentioning about saying hello to people. So I remember when Clouds and Water was downtown, and so often I would be walking from my car to Clouds and Water, and I was, you know, there almost every day, so a lot of back and forth. And since it was downtown, there were many more people than like we have here. I mean, I see people in the neighborhood here, but anyway, there I would often see several people like on my way, walking back and forth. And I used to have sort of just unconsciously realized that I would sort of wait to see like if someone would be look up at me or seem like they'd be receptive, and then I would say hello or good morning or good afternoon. And then I realized at one point it's like, I don't need to wait for that. Like, and actually, if someone like looks like they're in a bad mood, or if they're looking down, or, you know, actually me saying good morning or good afternoon might be something that would be helpful. And sometimes, you know, people would, not often, but would scowl at me like they didn't want to be interacted with. But mostly, it seemed like it was positive. So then I just carried that, you know, into my regular practice. So, it is something that seems small, but it could be, you don't know, you know, because sometimes people will report like, oh, I was about to go commit suicide and then someone smiled at me or someone said hello. So you don't really know what your impact is. And so I think just being reminded that there's big things we can do, but there's also small things that might have a big impact. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, I'm just thinking about, like, you have been practicing this kind of meditation. Like, you were a student of Katagiri Roshi, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, that your vow has sustained you for how many years, and how has that worked? I mean, how do you think you've been able to do that?
You know, my early practice, I was very formally involved at Minnesota Zen Center with Katagiri Roshi, and I had a pretty intensive practice. And then, and that was in the early 1980s, and then in the mid-1980s, I got married and had kids, And even though my practice wasn't so formal at Minnesota Zen Center, I still connected with the community, but I just, the teachings that were instilled in me, in my life, through, you know, through Katagiri Roshi and Minnesota Zen Center, they didn't go away. They were still there and informed how I lived my life. And there were times in my life, in my family life, that were very, very difficult. And there were times when I was very isolated. And knowing that the practice was there, and actually for me, the idea of impermanence was a very optimistic teaching, because it was like, I knew that things wouldn't always be this way. And I didn't know if in the everyday world, some of those things they could have ended badly, or they could have ended well. But they would end, you know? And so they did, I guess, end up fairly well. And then as my children got older, then I was able to get back to more formal practice and back to the community. And my heartfelt vow, actually from when I was in my mid-20s, when Katagiri Roshi, I had asked him to ordain me, and he said the food's not quite right, which I think was wonderful, because it gave me the opportunity to go out and live in the everyday world, in my everyday life. But on my back burner, I had this percolate, this simmering pot of wanting to be ordained. And when the time was right 20 years later, that aspiration and that vow was able to be realized. And so just keeping the pot sipping on the back burner, and maybe boiling times, you know, but and at this time, you know, all the stuff that early on, you know, Minnesota Zen Center, early on, we were a sangha, but there was all this competition and all this baloney of organizations and societal stuff. And now so many of us are still involved, and we've let go of all the baloney, you know. And that comes with some kind of maturity. So my sangha really sustains me.